and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by USIP's Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and my co-host for today's podcast is George Lopez. He is the Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP, and he's also the instructor in the course that we are offering this month on the Global Campus called Strategic Peacebuilding. So, George, it's great to have you as a co-host on today's podcast.
And great to be here, and great to share with one of our colleagues now.
Excellent. Yes, our guest for today's show is Nadia Gerspacher. She has done extensive research and teaching on community policing, international police cooperation, and policing for countering violent extremism. And she's taught related courses both to police officers and in the university setting. And she's also developed online courses for various audiences. In addition, Dr. Gerspacher oversees several programs that prepare advisors to deploy on capacity-building missions. She addresses both readiness and pre-deployment training for military and civilians preparing to serve as capacity builders, working in partnership with the United States and European government agencies and organizations to diffuse the lessons learned and the curricula developed. So, Nadia, it is wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So, the topics that we're looking at this week are connected to the themes that we're covering in the Strategic Peacebuilding course. And the two kind of large components of strategic peacebuilding that we're looking at are the importance of recognizing the burdens of long-term violence. And the second component is the importance of eliciting from locals their plans for what a just and sustainable peace looks like. And there are two kind of specific examples of peacebuilding work or elements of peacebuilding work that help us dive into those components. The first is disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, or DDR. And the second is the role of gender in peace and conflict. George, did you want to add anything to that about kind of these two components of strategic peacebuilding?
Well, I think when you've got the two components and you've got the two issue areas, we probably have enough on our plate for about a three-hour show. So we're going to try to integrate those as best we can. I think one of the things that we try to convey in the course of the lessons and in this week's material is so much of this is filled with choices, and particularly the choices that occur when you're an external actor trying to be helpful. We work on the notion of eliciting from locals what it is that they see as the dynamic. You run into very, very different interpretations of the kind of disarmament and demobilization and reintegration you may want. And you run into both incredibly imaginative possibilities for reforming gender roles, but you also often run into pre-existing stereotypes, which may be culturally and otherwise challenging. So we have a full gamut of things to cover today, I think, Darren.
Great. So, Nadia, I'm going to ask you to start off telling us what community policing is, because just from hearing the word community policing, I feel like that can touch on both the burdens of long-term violence and that police officers are oftentimes on the front lines of conflict-affected environments and engaged in potentially violent exchanges with individuals and other groups. And then also eliciting plans from locals, this idea of community policing. How is that different from regular policing, if you will? So what is community policing, and how does it relate to some of these ideas of long-term violence and eliciting plans from locals?
All right. Well, it's a good question, because community policing is one of those terms that has as many definitions as people saying the word or the term. So it's really important for people to understand it. The community policing approach was developed probably about 35 years ago already. And the idea is to have the police understand that they're a service-oriented government institution which provides a public service which is fair, responsive, and equitable for the entire population, but in collaboration with the public that they serve. So this means that they engage in a variety of ways with their publics to ensure that they understand what the publics are facing in terms of threats, what kind of challenges they're getting in terms of getting police to respond to various issues that they may be facing, or even for the police to provide preventive services. So the idea of community policing, which is also sometimes called community-oriented policing, problem-solving policing, and a variety of other terms, is the idea that the police understands and has a mindset of that they are providing a public service and they are working in cooperation with the community. This actually means that both the police and the community both understand that they have to act as co-guarantors of their own security.
Can I ask a question here, Darren? Because I'd be curious, given that great articulation of what this is about, can you really train people up in this if their prior experience is the tough guy police model, or worse yet, no due process, the way we would talk about it within more democratic and peaceful societies? What does this kind of training entail?
So when we are trying to take a police, which police corps or police force, and turn it into a service, which is what we work on for the most part in most countries, when we have a militarized police for the most part, or police that really understand how to do what we call hard policing, or some people call traditional policing, which means they have no relationship with the community at all. And they're often used as a tool to repress opposition, dissent, or anything like that, any of those types of activities by their government. That's a mindset that people have. And police officers that have that mindset often have that mindset since they're a child, because they were policed that way, or their families are policed that way. So for police officers that have grown up as citizens being afraid of the police or running away from the police, or police officers who become officers and provide police services, but mostly behalf on of the government, or service to their government rather than to their public, it's difficult to get them to change. However, there are most police officers understand very quickly, if you engage with them, that they cannot do their work without the public cooperation. Now, what's most difficult is to get them to understand the long-term importance of cooperation, because you have a lot of police officers that have a difficult time thinking that they're not going to go collect intelligence for prosecution to build a case from their citizens or their community. But the problem is, the minute you use intelligence and someone gets arrested in community, that someone has family, has a mother, has a sister, or everybody has a mother at least, right? And that just then creates problems and distrust, because the police will now have violated the relationship that they had put to, they had built with a community. So it's difficult to do that, but there is what we teach them is mindset change sort of things, and specifically how to be responsive, which means respond every single time to one of the worst things you can do is to hurt the legitimacy of the police, is to not respond when you're being called as a police. So for them to respond, and then the procedures that they deploy at that time are crucial. So we need to train them on those kinds of things. So police officers are easily trained from a tactical standpoint. So showing them which forms to use and what procedures to follow is doable. The mindset change is more complicated, because unlike the military, the police has a lot of discretion. They don't call back to headquarters when they have an alleged criminal. They have to make their own decision. Just like if you're getting pulled over for a speeding ticket, the police officer can decide to give you a warning or let you go, or to give you a ticket. So they have discretion. That is the part that's the most challenging, is to allow them to exercise discretion. The way that we're working, the latest kind of approach, is to give police officers criminology, criminal justice, and sociology type of education from early age, like 15, and those kinds of things. A lot of countries are working toward that. For example, in Turkey, police officers are being taken out of their regular school, high school, and they are taken to a police college in which they learn root causes of crime, sociological problems, economic problems, things like that, so that they are maybe better able to exercise better discretion, more softer discretion, right, to understand some of the social issues that their publics are facing.
Let me jump in here, Darren, because there's a number of things, threads that I want to pick up from what Nadia shared with us. The first is that I'm brought back to the late 80s and early 90s in two different geographies. The first was in Latin America, where we were finally seeing the demise of a number of the terrible, brutal dictatorships and the rise of democratic movements and voting in popular elected governments, and then the call for the reformation of all of the systems, both military and police in that. And I remember I was doing a lot of work with human rights groups at the time and how difficult it was for outsiders who had spent maybe a decade documenting evidence of police brutalities, disappearances by the military and police squads, etc., who viewed those institutions on the basis of lots of good evidence as the enemy, that when the democratic transitions were occurring within states, a lot of the human rights communities said, okay, we replace these groups totally, or we have to have these major trials for accountability, et cetera. And those are important issues to deal with. But many of the locals, since one of our themes is eliciting from the locals, said, no, there are large numbers of people here who have shown the right way, can be reformed. And there are people. In the same way that Nadia says, you know, people have mothers, mothers also have sons. And not every police person was engaged in disappearances and torture, and many others were going about their business in a sense sort of hiding amidst some of the terrible realities of their institution. Those are the kinds of people that we learned quickly in Eastern Europe and in Latin America. They can, in fact, be retrained. They should be retrained because they've seen some of the worst but not participated in it themselves. And they're the people who could carry on later a heritage of why we want to do things in a particular community policing way, why you want to have due process, why you don't slug people up the side of the head as the way to bring them to a sensibility that you're under arrest. Those kinds of transformations in that period was an interesting dialogue between insiders and outsiders. And some in the human rights community externally really needed to be caught up a little bit more in understanding that people who are local have to help make those decisions. As correct as it is to enforce human rights norms, you sometimes have to see what's going on in the community as they see their relationship to police and others. The other thing that I wanted to mention is kind of more on the educational realm, since Nadia mentioned the training and the education in terms of professional criminal justice. One of the things that some of our listeners may find of interest is the area of most growth in the U.S. over the last 5 or 6 years of peace studies and conflict resolution and restorative justice courses coming together is in criminal justice programs. I'll be at a wonderful college at the end of the week, Valencia College, where so many of the peace studies majors are also co-majors in criminal justice. And that makes a lot of sense in such a multicultural dimension of Florida and the kinds of things that those young people will be involved in as professionals.
Some examples that you just talked about in terms of transitioning out of a authoritarian repressive regime where police took on this kind of, you know, hard policing strategy, if you will. I'm thinking like Chile under Pinochet and transitioning out of that, or the Philippines. Nadia, what are some other examples from history that you felt have given rise to this need for this idea of community policing?
Well, community policing comes out of the idea that in order to avoid serious crime, you need to prevent and address grievances in the community. And the many police scholars from a long time, probably about 40 years back now, have advocated how important it is for the police to show that they're available, basically the face of the government. In most places, the police is the face of the government. And so for the government to be able to show to their, through their police, or through their Ministry of Interiors and, you know, various countries, and centralized countries, that they are providing a service. And they have, there is some sort of outlets for getting protection, for being able to complain, for some sort of, even in some places, even some conflict resolution mitigation that takes place in some communities where the police is, you know, much more, much less specialized than in larger cities. So I think that's an important piece. If the community feels like we've seen, you know, in a variety of places in the past 5 to 10 years, if too many people are too upset and security is too difficult and the security threats are too large, people will take up arms themselves and they will find ways to protect themselves. What you see, for example, in a lot of places like in South America and even, for example, in Northern Ireland, we have the rise of vigilantism. Nigeria also is seeing a lot of the rise of vigilantism, which is people that are not really believing that their government will has the capacity to take care of them and to protect them. So then they basically find a way for them to protect themselves. Unfortunately, that gives rise to a sort of more violence, because vigilantism, for like just in Northern Ireland, for example, you have various community members that will give intelligence to vigilantes about a drug deal and will know who drug dealers are. And so we'll send the vigilantes to the door of the person so that they can give them an appointment in the evening so that they can either do a punishment killing or a punishment maiming, where they shoot people in the kneecaps. That's really far away from policing. That's not justice. That's not due process and those kinds of things. So the idea is really to say the people, the public needs to see the police as a legitimate provider of service that comes out of their taxes, out of their support for their government, and then the government is doing something with that. If you don't have that, you will have alternative means of security, which are always breed much more violence than you would expect.
You know, it's interesting, Darren, because let's look at the two sides in some respects that Nadia's talking about. On the one hand is an overreach, an overcapacity, an over-militarization of the police and security forces. And on the other hand is the undercapacity and in some cases unwillingness to provide protection or to do that only very, very selectively. Both are substantial problems undercutting the prospects for real peace. And you know, we're in an interesting and in some cases terrible time in certain sections of the United States. It's not just in other countries coming out of violence. I mean, certainly the experience of what we saw in Ferguson, Missouri is an example of what might be considered an over-militarized response by the police and a kind of historic absence of the community policing ethos and the contacts and the way to do human communication and conflict resolution to de-escalate the potential for violence when difficult situations occur.
Yeah, that's a good comment. And I'd like to invite our listeners around the world to chime in with their questions, comments, and insights. You can click the raise hand button on your GoToWebinar control panel, and we can unmute you and bring you right on into the show. Or you can type your question, and our producer, Vanessa Francis, will read your question on your behalf. So again, we invite you to join and help us guide this conversation. Yeah, George Ferguson was something that I was thinking about too. I've actually had some conversations with a police officer friend of mine who actually has a degree in conflict resolution from a top, you know, conflict analysis and resolution school. And he's no longer a police officer, but he served as a police officer for a little over 7 years. And just through his comments on Facebook, he was really emotionally connected to the perspective of the police officer. And the media, he felt, was really being unfair and not putting themselves in the shoes of a police officer. They don't know the full story. They weren't in that police officer's shoes. And, you know, I felt was a very bold thing for him to say in this very public forum, considering how much anger, understandably so, there was around the killing of Michael Brown. So I'm wondering if you have experienced this working with police officers who have found themselves in very violent situations, you know, under threat, you know, maybe been harmed themselves, and they're very apprehensive to really take on this idea of community policing. And they said, you know, this isn't going to work. You know, you have to do hard policing because it's violent out there. People are out to get me. And, you know, just to stay, you know, stay alive and survive, this community policing thing just ain't going to work. Have you experienced that in some of the work you've done?
Yes. I actually ran a seminar in Abu Dhabi in April. And I had several people from North Africa, some police leaders and commanders from the police from these countries. And the first day was a very difficult day whereby they said, you know, what we need are heavy weaponry, and we need to make sure that we, you know, handle our threats in the way that our threats are being handled, right? When we talk about police for years, we've been talking and laughing, I guess, in a way that the criminals and the terrorists have Lamborghinis and the police officers have bicycles. It's the same with the weapons. It's the same sort of image. In several countries, actually many of the countries where we work, and in historically, the police has been the target of violence because they're actually the ones who have made the most enemies because of the violence they themselves engaged in. But it's important to be in the shoes of a police officer and to understand their daily life, especially in areas like, for example, in Tunisia, Northern Ireland, Nigeria, where they're actually, their life is at, you know, on the line every single day, whether they're in uniform or not. Their community knows who they are. In some instances, in some countries, they can't even go back to their community ever again. They'll be stoned to death. So being a police officer is a very, very difficult job. You have, in many of these countries, you don't have the backup, the support, administrative and tactical sort of support from your police institution. So they don't necessarily have, you know, you check out at roll call, you check out at radio, and there's no battery in it because there's no system to make sure that gets replenished. Or there are not enough bulletproof jackets for everyone out. So somebody goes out without them because they feel quite a bit, you know, they're on duty and they go out. So things can happen like that. So I think it is a very difficult job. And I just wanted to bring up the point that police officers do join to provide some sort of order, but their conceptualization of order is widely different, right? So it's really important for us who work with police officers to get them to understand that it is in their interest to lessen the amount of violence that they exert, because in return they will have less violence. They, you know, as we say, violence begets violence, and as police officers have to really be trained for restraint. There are some countries that are excellent, like Canada, for example, at training their police officers to be restrained, even in crowd control situations. But that really does calm things down. And just to the point that, you know, not everyone is a police officer that is violent and, you know, commits massive atrocities, etc. That's true. But even the ones that do, you know, they get orders, right? Again, Northern Ireland is very interesting in the conflict. It was, you know, it was London that was sending them orders to go crush Republican dissidents. They, when you speak to them today, who they are still in the service 30 years later, they didn't want to do that. But it was what they were supposed to do. It's their job. And then, of course, the discourse and the narrative that goes around it actually helps that. So those are some of the issues that you run across. But really, the idea is to get them to be an agent or an actor that helps to reduce violence.
This is the guts of conflict transformation. You know, I think it's the various sectors of a society, from the underemployed teenage youth to the parents to the ministers to the other influential people in a community to the police, all of whom have to make changes in order to create together a shared different future. But it's very much a give and take. It's very much an incremental kind of learning. Some of it's two steps ahead and one step back, but it's people in their primary communities, like police in their groups and people in their neighborhoods or with their own ethnic or religious group. That's where the locus of change occurs, and it's where it's also the toughest in which to engage.
Looks like we have a question or comment from one of our listeners.
We do. Doreen Abdul Karim has submitted a question for Nadia, but I'm sure you two gentlemen could also chime in. The person asks, Nadia, would you please touch on how community policing could have modified the regular role of police during the Arab Spring revolutions? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first, if they would have had crowd control training to promote de-escalation of conflict rather than help to escalate the conflict because of the response, that would have been a significant help. There are actually many programs since the Arab Spring in the US, the UK, and others who are helping to the police in Tunisia and Morocco and other places, even around the whole Sahel and Maghreb, that are helping them to develop these crowd control capacities. It is a very important piece because protests can remain somewhat peaceful protests or with a few elements, or because of the way the police will act when they're getting spit at in their face, or rocks are being thrown at them, or Molotov cocktails are being thrown at them, they have to get trained to have restraint, because they will be the agents who will make things worse as they deploy violence. You know, arrests and arrests with respect of human rights and those kinds of things are important. So I think it's really important to give them those capacities at that time, because then it, what happened during the Arab Spring, the revolutions, was that the people's fears about their government through the police actions became even more legitimized. And so it's really important to crowd control, understanding how to use, you know, various mechanisms to try to de-escalate the situation, disperse a crowd without violence. There are many, many ways. There are many police departments around the world that know how to do that and have that capacity. It takes a lot of psychological training and it takes a long time, but it is a very, very important thing. And so creating a crowd control capacity rather than having every police officer going out, but having a specialized crowd control force, like you would have a SWAT force or you would have a hostage negotiation force, you know, specializations, is important. So they are highly trained individuals who can handle that and can help to disperse a crowd without showing too much force. But that would have been really a good thing, and that's actually something that a lot of people are working on now.
Do you feel like you are fighting or teaching an uphill battle? In other words, are there, who's competing with you in this space and working with police officers and those in the security sector in terms of how to do their work? You're talking about community policing and these various dynamics, but are there other schools or trainings that police officers go to that say, hey, here's a way to really just quell a demonstration, you know, in a very hard, violent way, and here's the latest, greatest assault rifle and, you know, militarized gear, and here's how to use it with great force. Are you competing with other groups and trainings in this space?
The most complex operations like Afghanistan and Iraq, for example, we do see that specifically because the special forces and the military of various countries are training the police, because they're the only ones who have the capacity to survive in that space and to secure that space enough to do police training. So you do have some of these issues that arise because police is much more militarized. So you take a military officer from any country that's highly trained, they will teach the police to be highly militarized, and they will teach them to use force much more than, for example, an NYPD police officer who understands, you know, very crowded urban centers and how you, you know, use the sort of even the use of force at the completely at the last resort. So there is some competition, but I would say that it's mostly and even less these days because the mistakes of Iraq and Afghanistan are very clear in most people's minds, that there is definitely a consensus that the public needs to be in cooperation with the police and that they should be part of the solution. And the other issue is talking about local actors and engaging them. It's important. Most people that are doing police reform work understand that it is important to have a solution in which both the police institution and the community have buy-in to. So if you incorporate new procedures like new complaint systems or these kinds of things, it has to be something that works for both the police and the community, but they have to have buy-in because both are operating on their own will and their own discretion. So it's not as competitive as you may think. I think one of the greatest issues is sometimes we go a little too far in the local ownership principle and we ask locals what they want, and we don't necessarily, and we give them exactly what they want, which means we can then again get to vigilantism or informal police and those kinds of things because they just don't want to legitimize the police. And that's somewhat problematic, or actually in some places very problematic.
You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by USIP's Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and my co-host for today's show is George Lopez, and our guest is Nadia Gerspacher. So I want to go back to the Egypt example. You were talking about vigilantism, because one of the things that I remember reading as kind of a success amidst Tahrir and the revolution against Mubarak was how members of the community inside Tahrir, but also in their neighborhood, they had no trust in the police. That was part of the problem in the first place. So they took it upon themselves to protect their homes, to protect those who are in Tahrir. And again, I think a lot of stories and news articles were shared about this is a great example of how community can come together to kind of provide their own security. So are there examples where one person's vigilantism is another person's like ideal version of community policing or community-based security?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I just met a woman from Afghanistan, to give you just a quick and other example to illustrate what you're saying. And she lives in a neighborhood in Kabul, and she created an organization to help secure her neighborhood, her and other mothers. And they decided that they were going to take a little bit of money, a portion of their income every month, and put it into a fund. And that fund would contribute to paying the police officers, right? So then the police officers would get remunerated much more than they are, because that's really a big problem. What they're creating there is an environment in which the people that, you know, are in that environment feel highly threatened and insecure. It's completely understanding, right? If I was threatened on a daily basis to that level, my children were threatened, I couldn't let them walk to school, I couldn't get them, you know, I think I would do the same. I, listening to her story or listening to some of this, I understand that. And I think that, when you're a local actor, it's very understandable that you would do that. When you're an international actor, it's much more complicated, and we really need to be thinking about police capacity. We really need to be thinking about, if we're going to help some of these countries, while they do have immediate security needs and short-term band-aid type of solutions, that's normal, and we would all probably all do it. But when we're talking about foreign assistance projects and various capacity building projects that come from donor countries, we really have to be very, very careful, because we really need to help the government provide a police that is public centric. If we don't, we are going to create people that are armed against each other, and that will continue to clash, and we're not helping the system. In the situation in the Kabul story, this woman, while she's helping to, you know, secure her family and the others who can pay, by, because the people that can't pay will not get the security, and that's also an issue. But they are actually giving an excuse to the government for being corrupt, for taking international funds and funneling them somewhere else, and not fixing their police pay process and system. So this is just sort of perpetuating the problem. So I would say, and I say this in many different places, it's understandable that a local person who's facing these threats every day would do this, and I understand. But I think we really need to think, and when we help them, we really need to help to create a police that's doing that job. Now, the liaison type of officers that police has could be those vigilantes. So these individuals that are supposed to be providing security but are non-statutory forces, so that they're not part of the system, could become, in some reform, you know, down the road, could become these individuals who provide the liaison between the actual police and the community. They could be switched over to sort of these communal leaders that are advisors for security or something like that. But they're not the police, and they need to expect things of the police. The key piece of police reform is that you raise expectations for police conduct and response.
So one of the issues that we're looking at this week in the course to explore the burdens of long-term violence and eliciting plans from locals is the DDR process, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. And you've been doing a lot of work around security sector reform. And both of these I see as being an integral part of recognizing and dealing with these burdens of long-term violence. People who've been armed and have been fighting for a very long time, and they've taken a huge toll on their life. Those who were uniformed and part of the government, George, you provided some examples, you provided many examples, who were in that position, again, engaging in extreme forms of violence for many years. Do you see there being an overlap between DDR and SSR? And if so, what is that overlap?
So DDR is demobilizing, disarming, and reintegrating combatants. It is, by most SSR professionals, considered as the first step to reform, or one of the first steps. So taking away the weapons from either military or militarized police, taking their weapons away, decommissioning them, which means you take their uniform, they're no longer in their service, is something that most missions now are pretty apt at. The big problem is reintegration. Reintegration processes are extremely short-term for the most part. Taking a next combatant who, you know, joined the forces at probably 16 or 17 or even before in some instances and some less statutory mechanisms, they don't know how to do anything. So they really do need to spend a lot more time on being reintegrated to society, learning new skills. So the biggest lesson of DDR is to say we first have to reintegrate individuals. Now, that is seen as the foundation of being able to do security sector reform, right? But as George was mentioning earlier, you have to be careful who you demobilize, because we have some issues when we have a brand new force. You know, you see it in a lot of areas. In Iraq, we did the debathification of the security services. It didn't work so well because there was a way to start completely brand new, and it was really very problematic. And the security sector reform work afterwards was highly, very, very difficult. You have a highly insecure, hostile environment and no one to do anything about it while you're training everyone. So the training process of new individuals who have never been socialized as citizens as being provided a public-centric type of protection is a very difficult thing. So it's a longer process. Security sector reform often is better off when, you know, there's a very, very careful. So DDR is very important, but it has to be very carefully orchestrated. And, you know, the vetting process and all those kinds of things have to be very, very important. I would actually argue that it needs to be done from a institution building, capacity building sort of approach. So you establish new structures, new mechanisms for the types of officers you want. And if they are part of the older guard and they fit the profile, they should be admitted into that. Whatever profile of the individuals you need would be, so that you sort of handle it from a human resource management perspective rather than a pure post-conflict DDR, because that's really difficult.
Interesting. We have a question or a comment from one of our listeners.
Yeah, we have both. We have a complimentary comment from Sylvester, and complimentary in that it goes with what you guys were just talking about. What generally happens in most post-conflict countries in terms of community policing is a lack of a strong political will to support training and education of police officers who join the police institution from former combatant groups. And that would require absolutely a long-term process. So the question is, how do you think peace builders should face these challenges?
Well, let me speak to it from a policy point of view. And if Nadia wants to, she can speak to it from some of the practical training dynamics. I think Sylvester's right on the mark. It is all about political will and what's the context of making that political will decision on the part of authorities that are usually civilian authorities with a control of the emerging new police force. It's very, very important, I think, to understand this is why our critique, if you will, of the DDR process rests heavily on the reintegration, because that transition of former combatants through a screening process to folks saying, well, you'd be a good sergeant in this police unit, or you'd do well in the new community policing program we're trying to establish. We're very good at the decommissioning and reorientation and putting a new uniform on, but the process of building both the individual and the units they're part of and the neighborhoods and communities to be integrated to must all have its stage and its reinforcing kind of training. And it's the kind of thing that takes much longer than many international agencies are willing to fund. It's the kind of thing that demands some continued monitoring, reevaluation, and new trainings based on the experiences that people have it. You know, you may have a disproportionate of folks who really do fit the profile of the kind of community policer you want to have, but they're exactly the ethnic group that was on the wrong side for this community in which they're placed. And the community may not be yet ready for community policing, which is based heavily in the other that they spent 30 years at war at. And that creates a heavy burden on the police, both individually and as a unit. How do external agencies help in that community training, reintegration, and in the kinds of a forum you create to bring people together in this way? It's a very, very tough part of the reintegration that some of us believe doesn't have enough legs to it as programs unfold on the ground.
Yeah, I can just add that, you know, when we're talking about reforming police, we're talking about making them more responsive to their public. We have to understand that that will mean there will be losers of change. And the losers of change are usually individuals who are in power. And unless you're talking about an Arab Spring where there's a revolution and the government or some measure of the government dissolves, a lot of times it's much more incremental than that. And so there will be some losers if all of a sudden we decide that we want to make sure we pay police officers to a living wage so they become less corrupt. There will be some losers in that. And that's where a lot of the lack of political will actually comes from. Corruption issues like that, or even sometimes it means that someone will lose their job, or that someone there will be some shuffling of staff in a ministry or in a police institution, and that makes a big difference because some people's careers have been built on some of these issues. So it's the lack of political will is key, but sometimes you know you have to understand where it comes from.
It sounds like there's a lot of work around forgiveness that gets talked about in these trainings, perhaps one on the side of the uniformed police officer who, as you mentioned earlier, maybe in Northern Ireland had been told for decades that you need to go in and, you know, quash this uprising. And now many years later, they say, I didn't want to do that. And that was hard for me to do. And so the ability for them to forgive themselves for things they may have done or violence they may have committed, and now they need to come to grips with that. And then also to George's point about communities, whether it's, you know, ethnic or tribal or religious-based conflict, and now through a reintegration process or a security sector reform process, police are now re-entering into their community, but those uniformed police or security are from that tribe or that ethnic group that harmed them in the past. And are they able to then forgive that group for atrocities in the past? And you said earlier that there's a lot of psychological dimensions to doing this work. What does that look like in these trainings, this work around the psychological components of policing, working with individuals in violence or conflict affected communities, and the ability for folks who are trying to reform and reintegrate to forgive themselves?
Yeah, I don't know that forgiveness is definitely an excellent sort of link and theme here. I wonder how many work to forgive themselves and how many just are in denial and how many are defensive. It's difficult. For example, in Northern Ireland, you have police officers or the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which were very heavy-handed police. They were also dealing with very, very heavy-handed dissidents. But they engage in a variety of ways. And because it's a very small community, and like in many places, actually, you have people that have to begin to understand, right? So a lot of the training and the work that we do and that others are doing is to promote mutual understanding and to learn the skills to understand. It changes someone's perspective if they were arrested in a way that's brutal, or if their house was searched in a way that where a lot of, you know, violence ensued. It helps them to understand, potentially forgive, or at least understand mentally that the police is under threat, that they're trying to, their operations that they organize are meant to address particular threats. There was a not too long ago a police raid in Northern Ireland. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was a bomb that was, there was intelligence that a bomb had was in the final stages of production or construction. And so the police went to raid this house on 3 o'clock in the morning, and 16 armored Land Rovers came down barreling down the street at 3 o'clock in the morning and scared everybody. And you know, it was extremely difficult. This was 3 years ago. So way after the peace process and the switch to a new police. But the best way to deal with that is for the police and the community to sit down together and explain each other's perspective and really gain a mutual understanding. The police explaining that if we had 2 Land Rovers, the whole neighborhood would have come down on us, tipped over the Land Rovers, and probably would have had either gotten killed, had to leave, or something like that. So our to secure our operation and to provide protection to the community, we had to show the strength to this force. Is it completely validated? Is it completely absolutely accurate that they needed that much force? Not necessarily. So they also have to make to be willing to show that they're taking feedback and they're tweaking and maybe studying their approach and they're listening to the community. So there's, I think what we can hope for the most is mutual understanding and learning the skills to want to understand it, how you establish that, which one of the key ways is I just, when I lead these kinds of trainings, I just ask, teach people to ask why. Just why was that operation conducted in this manner for the police and then for the police officers to explain what their procedure is, right? And that's it. No judgment, nothing additional, so that there could be a mutual understanding and maybe then a discussion about how things can be done differently still while still securing the space.
Let me take this great example that Nadia's given and go to about 10,000 feet with our participants because you know, in this course that we've called strategic peace building and had lots of discussion the first week about what makes it strategic, obviously this kind of training at the local level and a bit of trial and error and discussion is very, very essential. What's also essential is that the agencies that are funding the training are in dialogue with locals and other agencies about the fit and place of this kind of trial and error and training in the larger worldview. The larger view is that we want communities that are protected. We want police that can do their job, but in a new and community-oriented way. We want a dramatic reduction in violence. We want communities to supply police with intelligence if the spoilers and outliers are going to continue to build bombs. So the synergy and interaction is critical. What does leadership in both local politicians, religious, and other leaders, what does the international community do to forge the right messages, to engage in reinforcing the right messages that make this kind of trial and error possible, but not powder kegs or triggers to violence? How do you dispel rumor? How do you engage in all of this? On the forgiveness issue that you raised, Darren, you know, forgiveness is one issue, but there's also lots of other emotional, psychological, and social psychological space that needs to be free and open to people. People, before they can ask forgiveness, have to have their memories validated. And so one of the big issues with dealing with long-term violence is how do people record memory? How can communities and individuals get together and remember without maybe either accusing or being paralyzed by fear? But just where's the recording of memory? What's the trauma dimension of this? And how does individual and collective trauma healing occur? How do groups come together to share both the horror of their stories and the resilience and heroics they saw under the worst conditions? How do people come and ask for a kind of forgiveness? You know, in the 90s, as we were struggling with all of these questions, the transition in South Africa yielded a kind of interesting model that became for a while for many the absolute perfect way to do things. It is Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where you decided that it's important for people to maximize truth and maximize reconciliation and worry less about individual accountability, etc. We want to make a transition, that their decision is to make a transition to a society which was not going to be based on retribution and various other things. And for South Africa in the early 90s, a lot of that worked. There was forgiveness, there was memory, there was incredible truth-telling. And many in that society felt that that was important for them to move forward. Then you saw a decade later or 15 years later, the children of the architects of this, and then more recently the grandchildren say, you let them get away with what? These oppressive police, the people who assassinated our nephew, the people who did this to grandpa, you let them get away with what? How come there wasn't accountability? How come there weren't trials? And so you have all these interesting and often culturally appropriate, situationally appropriate, different kinds of truth commissions. They're not truth and reconciliation, but they're truth investigations. They're based on more legal models. And the legal models play their way out in a number of different places. And then you have now the more recent call for many that what's most important is reconciliation, a legal process may in fact reinforce the notion that, yes, people are accountable for their crimes. New institutions need to be built a certain way, but we also know that's not all there is. There still has to be forgiveness and reconciliation and trial and error. So it's a very, very complex process, as we've seen over the last 30 years.
We have another question or comment from one of our listeners.
Yeah, a couple of our listeners are thanking George and Nadia for their comments on how to do certain things, but they're curious as to when in a conflict zone, when you should actually start doing some of these things. Someone specifically identified the forgiveness and reconciliation process and also the vetting process that comes in to the SSR process of police officers and putting them, if they're an ethnic minority, perhaps in a community where they maybe not thrive. So if you could speak to that.
Well, I think it's very difficult to put some of this in place if there aren't some guarantees that a larger peace process is underway, or better yet, has led to a ceasefire and things are taking hold. You really jeopardize a lot in the community if you begin this process too early. Now, that said, there are a number of examples, I'm sure, where you take what the communal situation gives you. There are zones of peace that can be created, and patterns of reconciliation and new institutional practices built in communities that decide, look, this is no longer for us. There's going to be continued violence in other sectors of the country, but we may have an opportunity here to do something useful and unique that will only contribute better to the national psyche once all the conditions are right. And so it's a judgment call in part, but I think by and large, it's very difficult to really undertake these processes that need new resources longer term to take hold unless you have a semblance of a larger peace being in place. I don't know what your experience and feelings are about that, Nadia.
Yeah, I would just address that question of in most places that are highly insecure, you can't start bringing police officers right away because they don't have the skills or the ability, nor should they, to survive in these kinds of types of environments. And they definitely don't have the capacity to protect populations. So we work a lot with what is the transition from bringing in the military to secure the space and reduce hostilities and insecurities, to especially when you're talking about terrorism, insurgencies, rebellions, those kinds of things, or even violence extremist groups and what's going on in Iraq. And those are it's very, very difficult to bring in any sort of civilian police, right? And moreover, it's very important not to bring them in right away if that's the situation, because what you don't want to do is to put the police in a situation in which they will have to exert a lot of violence in front of the people that is supposed to eventually trust them. So it's very difficult. It's a case-by-case scenario. There's a lot of work being done here in Washington and other places about what is that transition. Ideally, you bring the police as soon as possible, because if they're well-trained, they can de-escalate. But that's actually very difficult to get them to train, to get them to be able to provide that kind of service. So it's really important to understand the role that the military can have, international militaries, but also local militaries, who themselves can eventually, when things hopefully calm down, will be able to leave the space and no longer be seen and be seen as a legitimate defender of the territory. And then the police will themselves, you know, step in as the protector. And it's really important for the public to see these various forces, to be label them correctly. Otherwise, we've seen this over and over in the past 10, 15 years, that we're putting in police officers, we arm them as constabulary forces, paramilitary forces. And then the next day they're trying to help, you know, a child and a mother cross the street. You know, that's not going to work. Or they hope that the community will share information about their neighbor, but that's not going to work. So the police cannot instill fear, cannot show too much force. So there's a lot of that work that, you know, that we do, but it really is a case-by-case basis. It's even a city-by-city basis in some countries.
And one final point, if I may, you know, how elongated this happens to be is pretty clear. If we're going to have a real transition to full aspects of peace and a really vibrant community policing operation, this takes a long time. I mean, here's Nadia working with a wonderful set of locals in Northern Ireland, trying 10 years after the Good Friday Accords to yet make inroads and get it right and trying to reduce certain extremisms and trying to reduce the vulnerability of the community to little triggers that spark violence and revenge. So if you're a decade past a peace process, there's been a huge commitment on the part of many in the community and in the police to get it right, and you're still looking for ways to make sure you can do that. This is no easy task. It's back to that strategic vision that we've talked about since the beginning of the course. If you're in a 20, 30-year war, don't be surprised that it's not going to be a 20 or 30-year process by the end.
Nadia, we have one more question for you, and wish I'd brought it up earlier, but you've been doing this fascinating work in very complex environments, sensitive environments. How did you get involved in this field, and why did you decide to get involved in this field?
I was really, really very interested in transnational crime for a very long time. I wanted to look at how countries respond to transnational crime and terrorism. And so I started looking at the way police is done in various countries, and specifically how police cooperate across countries and create international investigations by sharing information. What I found through studies and research projects was that there's a lot of capacity building of police that needs to take place before investigations actually can take place. Because a lot of times you can have, for example, for drug trafficking, you can have a supply country which has very little capacity, or many different countries' police institutions do not trust the information that's sent to them, so they won't work there. But then maybe some transit countries will also have a very weak international outreach and cooperation mechanisms. So then at the end, sometimes the supply states or countries will not have very much to prosecute on. So I was very interested in how much capacity building you need to do, especially in supply and transit countries. Could be drugs, could be human trafficking, could be organs, could be art, could be anything. You have a variety of different supply and transit countries which don't have the police capacity to put together investigations at that level. So that's where I got interested.
Great. Well, thanks, Nadia, so much. You've been listening to The Peace Frequency. Our guest has been Dr. Nadia Gospacher. She's the Director for Security Sector Education at the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP. And we've also had our co-host, George Lopez, who's the Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thank you, Darren, and thanks to all of our audience out there for, again, a great session.